Well, the incredible stories just keep on coming. Linda Moulton Howe with us. Next up, we're going to talk about GMOs, but in a different way. Linda will explain when we come right back. Welcome back, Linda Moulton Howe with us. Linda, as you know, we do a lot on GMOs on this program. Jeffrey Smith, of course, an expert on GMOs. The Monsanto case and the General Mills case and Cheerios, all right, mixed into one.
That's right. This 2014 is getting off to quite a start in so many levels, and the new year began with food production giant General Mills announcing that it would start manufacturing its original Cheerios brand without genetically modified ingredients and would label those original Cheerio boxes as, quote, not made with genetically modified ingredients, close quote. And they have, and those boxes are out there, and that label is on them. Now, symbolically, this was a big step for consumer activists who have been trying to get genetically modified products labeled in supermarkets and other stores for a long time. A year ago, on March 8, 2013, the president of Whole Foods announced that by the year 2018, his company will label all of its products in North American stores that contain genetically modified ingredients. Celebrating these commitments by a large food producer and a large food distributor to separate GMO products from non-GMOs is Jeffrey Smith, you just mentioned. He's author of Genetic Roulette, The Gamble of Our Lives. Mm-hmm. Jeff is the executive director of the Institute for Responsible Technology in Fairfield, Iowa. And I recently asked Jeff to explain exactly what General Mills had done, since oats are not genetically modified crops, at least not yet. Here now is Jeffrey Smith from Fairfield, Iowa.
When Cheerios announced that it was removing GMOs from its original Cheerios brand, it wasn't the oats. There are 9 genetically modified food crops in the United States, and oats is not one of them. It was the cornstarch and the sugar. Sugar comes in the United States from 2 sources, sugar cane and sugar beets. The sugar beets are genetically engineered, and the sugar cane is not. So one of the things that they did was simply to divert their supply chain to the pure cane sugar instead of the sugar beet. And so that was easy to eliminate. The second thing they did was to use non-GMO corn to derive their cornstarch. The biotech industry does plan to genetically engineer all the food in the supermarket. The stated goal of Monsanto, as reported by its consultant in 1999, was to genetically engineer 100% of all commercial seeds in the world and patent them.
With Monsanto and others patenting seeds and taking over food production, especially in the United States with genetically modified crops, the reduction in biodiversity on this planet could be one of the biggest threats in the future to having plants that can survive climate change.
And this is exacerbated by the biotech industry's intention to commercialize what's called the Terminator technology. Brazil picks up that vote in February, and if passed, it means that these companies can produce genetically modified crops that create sterile seeds. Now, when this technology was developed, the brochures boasted that it was to focus on the 1.4 billion farmers on the planet who save their seeds. That's 1.4 billion. And when they save seeds, that means they have the best quality seeds for their local climate and geography.
Right.
So there's millions upon millions of different types of seeds in the hands of these different farmers. If the biotech industry can send out, even in 1 year or 2 years, their Terminator technology, which stops the seed saving, seed plantings, and then forces the farmers to just buy from the limited genetics in the seed catalog, they are taking the greatest gamble with the human population in history at a time of global climate change, when the diversity of crops is really our security.
To develop Terminator seeds is to have a monopoly on patented seeds for profit.
They would argue that it prevents contamination, because if you plant GM crops with Terminator seeds in one field, if the seeds end up going somewhere else, they can't be replanted. But of course, the pollen may cause neighbor's plant to become sterile, in which case it has a tremendous negative impact, because then the farmers that may be saving seeds in the neighboring region can no longer use their own seeds. So there's a devastating impact on seed saving. But what happens is this: when you buy a genetically modified seed from Monsanto and others, you sign a technology agreement that forces you not to replant. So that way, you have to go back to Monsanto's catalog year after year. This is done legally right now in contractual law. They want to make it biological law, so that if you buy their seeds, it will not grow if you replant it. So the main thing is to force farmers to replant the seeds, to repurchase the seeds year after year. In their efforts to try and stop farmers from replanting, Monsanto has gone after legally those who clean soybeans for farmers that want to replant their soybeans. And this is an age-old practice that's been going on for a long time, but Monsanto has taken to court some of these seed cleaners to try and stop this practice.
How could this go forward without pushback from populations all over the world?
Well, that's what we have with Cheerios. It's interesting that it's very easy to be concerned about Monsanto and the patenting and the grab of patents and the whole way that they do business. People are angry at Monsanto for putting out PCBs, Agent Orange and DDT, which turned out to be poisonous. But what really drives the global picture in GMOs, especially in the United States, are consumer decisions. Here, we've been educating people about the health dangers of GMOs. For example, the American Academy of Environmental Medicine links them with gastrointestinal disorders, immune system problems, reproductive disorders, accelerated aging, organ damage, and thousands of doctors are prescribing non-GMO diets, and more people are learning about it, so that according to Hartman Group, 39% of Americans are actually saying that they are seeking non-GMO ingredients. Mm-hmm. It is this market dynamic which kicked GMOs out of Europe. It's this market dynamic which made non-GMO labeled products the fastest growing labeled group in the United States in 2012. It caused Target to declare that its home brand would be non-GMO in 2014. Ben and Jerry's kicked it out. Chipotle's kicked it out. And all of the natural food industry is kicking it out now in very, very fast pace. And now Cheerios. So we're seeing the early signs of a tipping point in the United States. And our Institute for Responsible Technology is actually putting into place a master plan to accelerate that.
Are we potentially at a tipping point if Monsanto and the other GMO companies prevail and they end up being able to have patents on all of the seeds of all of the food and Terminator seeds so that they eliminate farmers being able to naturally save their best seeds?
That is unfortunately their trajectory. From 1999, the goal was to replace all genetically modified commercial seeds with genetically modified seeds. But now it is expanded beyond seed to include fish. The FDA wants to approve perhaps genetically modified salmon this year. They are genetically engineering mosquitoes. They've released them in Malaysia, Cayman Islands, and Brazil. And now the company Oxitec wants to release it in Key West. They want to genetically engineer virtually all living organisms, because there's a lot of money to be made in these patents. And so if we do nothing and the biotech industry has its way, then we have an irreversible situation where everything that we have held dear from nature is replaced by the Monsanto version and the DuPont version and the Bayer version. And that's not something we can retreat from. The genetic pollution is irreversible, at least to some level. In other words, the genes already released by Monsanto will outlast the effects of global warming and nuclear waste. The only thing that lasts longer than genetic pollution is extinction. And so we're talking about a technology that can influence all living beings and all future generations. So this is really an epic challenge right now, an epic battle between these two ways of thinking, whether we save the nature of nature or whether we hand it over to the biotech industry so they can use their immature technology, which is prone to side effects, which is being promoted by tobacco science and checkbook science, and they're covering up the health dangers, and they're covering up the environmental dangers, and they're putting us at risk. This is a bizarre situation, Linda, where the entire fate of all living beings and all future generations may come down to the sales of Cheerios in Walmart. Let me explain. Once a product like Cheerios declares itself as non-GMO, if it increases in sales and market share, and the GMO competitors on the same shelf languish and reduce market share, it tells the rest of the food industry that they better become the first in their product category to declare non-GMO, or they too will lose market share. The way that I look at the strategy going forward to stop GMOs, we've already created a tipping point of consumer rejection within the natural products. This was made clear by the Whole Foods president interview in March of 2013, where he told the Associated Press that when a product becomes a non-GMO project verified, it increases sales by 15 to 30%. They also announced at the time that they would require non-GMO project verification for all GMO claims in their store. Otherwise, by 2018, products would have to be labeled as containing GMOs. So right now, we have thousands and thousands of products in the pipeline to be verified as non-GMO. So what we have now already moved the Whole Foods shopper, moved the natural product store shopper. What we need to do is to move just a small percentage of the shoppers in Walmart and Safeway and Kroger's, etc. So we have a crowdfunding campaign to create mini documentaries of mom's experiences that we have heard over and over again. I'll give you one example. I was speaking at MIT with another scientist about the dangers of GMOs, and I asked the audience, have any of you removed GMOs and noticed any effect on your health? The woman shot up her hand and said, my 6.5-year-old was violent and out of control. They wanted to kick him out of school. I saw your film, Genetic Roulette, The Gamble of Our Lives, changed his diet, and within a month I had a new child. None of the problems persisted. We have parents talking about allergies and asthma and ADHD and skin problems and weight problems disappearing after putting their children on non-GMO diets. So we want to document these in ways that can be released in social media to ignite moms across America against GMOs. In addition, we have been very successful at presenting in medical conferences and medical school. I've talked to 7 groups in the last 7 months. We have thousands of doctors now prescribing non-GMO diets and linking GMOs to specific disorders, which they see clear up in the patients that take their advice. We are also linking GMOs to specific diseases and disorders and letting that go through social media within the patient support groups.
In another 50 years, food may be a huge problem on the planet precisely because of what these corporations are doing.
It's exactly right, Linda. We have a very, very dangerous situation, and they would argue the opposite. They argue the myth that GMOs are needed to feed the world, even though they actually lower yield and increase the use of chemicals and concentrate the ownership of seeds. It's a really dangerous situation.
He's the best, Linda, isn't he?
He really is. He really, really cares. And he and I have talked about the fact that we have now a half a dozen corporations that are basically dominating the food of the planet, and GMOs are what they want. They want the patented seeds and that profit flow. And now here comes this next big, huge issue of these Terminator seeds. They're also called by some people suicide seeds because they are genetically engineered to have one season of growth and then the seeds become sterile. That's why they're called Terminator or suicide seeds. And what is coming up in February in Brazil, if all goes forward as it is expected, goes back to the 1990s when the United States Department of Agriculture made an agreement with the Agriculture Research Service to produce seeds that after one generation, they would go sterile. And this meant that farmers could not save seeds from season to season, but they would be forced to purchase new seeds, which of course was capitulating to corporations like Monsanto that want to keep making their revenue stream on brand new seed sales every year. And the argument, as Jeff pointed out, is because Monsanto has sued so many farmers for saying that their patented seeds would end up in somebody's farm and they hadn't paid for them, and the farmer would say the wind blew it over, and all of that has been going on. So now the idea is they get these Terminator seeds, and people can buy a crop or even a non-food crop like trees, plant them, and then from then on, the seeds, the second year, the third year, the fourth year, the blow away out of the trees won't be able to grow anything more, and they won't be in violation of the patents that Monsanto and Dow and Syngenta and so forth have. This is the idea. Well, the current situation is that there has now been so much protest against the GMO Terminator seeds that 193 countries on this planet in 2000 signed a United Nations Convention on Biological Diversity that called for an international moratorium on these Terminator seeds, and everything was going along fine through the last decade until landowners in Brazil said that they wanted to plant large areas with very fast-growing, genetically engineered trees that could spread seeds over wide areas. And so they liked the idea of Terminator seeds that they would plant and get their whatever their tree crop was, and then they wouldn't have to worry about any kind of lawsuits or problems of the trees sprouting up someplace else. And now this fight between the Terminator seed supporters and environmental groups that are warning there will be destructive global consequences if this Terminator seed goes through now in Brazil, because what will happen is that it will automatically dent a moratorium that has been on this planet for at least a decade, agreed upon by 193 countries, and money is pushing this issue in Brazil. The landowners there are have a lot of power, they have a lot of money, that want these Terminator seeds in things like trees. And so February, we're right at the end of January, in the next 4 weeks, we should know who wins in Brazil in the congressional vote there. And hopefully the environmentalists will prevail this time, because George, I think you and I and others, we have done so many interviews with so many scientists who are warning that the genetically modified crop is one of the bigger questions for the future, because we are already seeing that the crops that come out of GMOs are weaker. Biodiversity goes way down to a few species. More weeds grow, more pesticides are needed. And now, if Terminator seeds dominate, the countries that depend upon saving seeds year by year, and they are the strongest seeds, the strongest crops, are now perhaps going to be threatened by this brand new suicide seed. And this, George, is one of the, I think, one of the most serious issues on the planet.
Oh, my God. It could be a planet killer.
Food in the future of a planet destined to have 10 billion humans living on it in another 25 years. And we are seeing the, what, for money, it's cutting off the nose despite the
feet again
for greed.
It's all about the money. Linda, we're going to come back and talk about this very strange world forum. And then next hour, Conversations with Linda. And welcome back. Linda Moulton Howe with us. Next hour, Conversations with Linda. But she's still got another story to go when we come right back. And we're with Linda Moulton Howe. Linda, this other story, this is a strange story. What did you uncover?
Well, I'm not sure what your reference is in terms of strangeness, because The World Economic Forum was founded in January of 1971, several decades ago. And so every January it meets in Davos, Switzerland, the powerful people on the planet with the most money.
They're sinister.
Well, this is going to be a very interesting story because it's a confluence of several things all at the same time in January. So here you've got the cycle of the World Economic Forum every January since 71, and the day before it started in Davos on January 22nd, the day before on the 21st, Oxfam, which is a foundation that has dedicated itself internationally to try to help the poor, released a report, a study, in which it said that the assets of 85 wealthy people on this planet, that's 85 individuals in a planet of 7 billion, they have assets that are equal to everything together of 3.55 billion of the poorest on the planet. These are incomprehensible numbers of the disconnect between the haves, the have-nots, the 1% driving the 99% of the world, all of the things that we have been hearing, especially since the big depression of or a recession of 2008 going forward. So now, at the same time that Oxfam is reporting that 85 of the wealthiest people on the planet have assets equal to 3.55 billion, which is half the world's population, and that you have the World Economic Forum meeting in Davos, there is a release that I got on the web having to do with a report that was put together by a Switzerland systems theorist named James Glatfelder. And it was an analysis of 43,060 transnational corporations based on statistics from the Bureau van Dijk in the Netherlands. BVD, as it's known, specializes in business intelligence with some 30 offices around the world. And James Glatfelder collaborated with the Zurich office and used the BVD Orbis Global Companies database. His conclusion, 730 shareholders in those 43,060 transnational corporations control a whopping 80% of the entire revenue of that Orbis network of those thousands of corporations.
That's huge.
Now, further, when the 730 shareholders were further analyzed, only 146 had the potential control of 40%. That's almost half of the entire revenue of all those corporations. So I called him to ask if he thought 20% controlling 80% would perpetuate itself for the foreseeable future or self-destruct. I heard for the first time about the Pareto principle from an Italian economist who studied distribution of income and wealth among populations. And he found that 80% of the land in Italy was owned by 20% of the population, 20% of the pea pods in his garden contained 80% of the peas, and he came up with this 80-20 rule that tends to be consistent in many, many, many parts of the earth and even the universe, or a power law of distribution. It's found throughout financial and natural systems, right down to biochemistry that keeps bodies alive. 20% is basically in charge, and 80% is there that is manipulated by the 20%. But why? And now, here is James Glatfelder from Zurich, Switzerland.
Unless you actually track all these network connections, you don't really see who is in the end controlling what companies. And this is something that we tried to figure out with our methodology. So we ended up finding out that there was this tiny core where all of the control in the network was flowing to. And within that, there was this even smaller group, 146 companies, and they have the potential to control 40% of all the value of the companies in this network. These are actually corporations, because it's interesting that individual people as shareholders, they turn out to not be as important as they used to be. So people like Warren Buffett or Bill Gates, they show up later in the ranking of the shareholders. The top shareholders are all US or British financial institutions. This is where the power is going to.
US and the UK and 146 corporations and 730 shareholders do control 80% of the entire revenue of that network?
Yeah.
I guess I'm surprised that it comes down to the UK and the US. In a world, we hear that China and India are the two largest emerging nations. You would think they would dominate perhaps this list.
Yeah, that's a good question.
1% of the planet is running all the rest of the 99%. That 1% to the 99% is close to what you are reporting.
Yes. I also see this as a great problem, this huge concentration of power and wealth distributed among fewer and fewer people. What we're actually looking at here is, it's called a scaling law distribution. The question always is this a conspiracy? Is this engineered? Are there masterminds behind this trying to manipulate the way the world works to get more wealth? But actually, it turns out that this particular distribution, which is very undemocratic because it says that very few nodes in a network are extremely important and most of the nodes in the network you can ignore, this is something that turns up over and over in nature and when you're dealing with complex systems. It's a natural thing which is actually happening. So I think this is a very important insight that we need to have, is that we're fighting against kind of like a law of gravity, because it's something which is going to happen on its own in these complex systems. And it's something which, it's always the same distribution. If it's 1% versus 99 or 20 to 80, this skewed distribution is something which is natural, which keeps popping up. And the question is, we don't want this from a democratic feeling, but what do we have to do to change this? Something which keeps happening naturally. If you think of this as a conspiracy, we have to see who's behind this and then we get rid of the people and we change it, but that's not going to solve this problem. It's something encoded into how these complex systems interact. This is something which we have to research and we have to find out. I don't think at the moment anyone really knows what we would have to change to make this system more equal.
But are you inferring that there is something Darwinian here, that only the strongest always survive, and that there is an ingredient about being king of the mountain?
No, because there's a threshold of how many links you can have in a network above which the network becomes unstable. So this is maybe something where the network itself self-organizes into a state which then allows it to destroy itself. One thing would be that we limit the amount of interconnections of these key players. If something goes wrong in the network, if one experiences distress, then this whole problem can just spread through the whole network like an epidemic. And the higher the interconnectivity is, the higher this probability is. This is quite a new insight, because not too long ago people thought the more links in the network, the more the problems are diversified. But actually, it's the inverse effect.
Aren't you describing exactly what happened in 2008 among all the controllers of money and banks and mortgages in the whole planet, that because a few corrupt companies were so interlinked multinationally that the whole system began to collapse?
I don't think you even need the element of corruption. You can just have a company which just failed for whatever reason, and this spread through the network. Actually, that's what we're seeing now, that people on the regulator's radar, the whole idea of systemic risk has come up, and this is something new, which also comes from these network analyses, because before it was like too big to fail, and it's actually, no, it's too connected to fail.
Right now, in January of 2014, going forward, do you think there is a big risk with all of this interconnectivity of 730 shareholders controlling 80% of the entire revenue in the world network that Van Dyke with Orbis is analyzing, that we are on a precipice where there could be gigantic economic failure again?
Yes and no. I think this is the problem for me personally, that it's so hard to make predictions at the moment because it's so unclear that indirect effect some actions will have. I do see that at the moment the whole financial world is very volatile. Small changes in the rules of how banks are allowed to interact could have a huge impact on the system and make it a lot more stable within a short time. So these are things you can't exclude. It doesn't look very good at the moment, but still from this, I think it could go either way, if it's going to stabilize itself or if it's just going to fall apart.
What do you think, after all the work that you have done, that makes the scaling law operate on systems, whether it is the web, bank, populations? What do you think causes the scaling law so that there is always at least a 20% controlling 80%, and now in many ways 1% is controlling 99%?
One is preferential attachment. So if you start to build the network and throw in new nodes, then the existing nodes in the network, the longer they've been there, the more they have become powerful. So this is one explanation, that if the longer I'm in the network and if you add new nodes, then I'm going to be more important than the new nodes. But what this means, all these diverse phenomena that you see scaling laws, and you see it in like the intensity of wars or the size of craters on the moon, and in metabolism, there's very few chemicals which are in all metabolic processes. There are very many which only contribute to few metabolic processes. I have no idea why this is such a universal phenomenon, and I really have no idea. I think all the explanations that I've seen, I don't get a feeling that they're really grasping why this structure, scaling law distribution, is emerging.
So you're talking about something that seems to be in the very fabric of the cosmos, some mathematical rhythm in which everything from metabolism to who dominates the web, what happens in banking systems, to population distribution, that it all somehow comes down to the scaling law, where 20% of something is always going to be controlling 80%.
Yes, although I wouldn't necessarily call it a mathematical law, but more kind of an algorithmic phenomenon. So it's something which happens if you have many agents interacting in a system. There's another interesting thing, that in the last 4 billion years of life on Earth, there's been 10 or 12 near extinction events where life was nearly wiped out on Earth. And from all of these catastrophic events, life continued again and became even more complex. The last extinction event was when people think that the dinosaurs got wiped out by asteroids. And from then on, the mammals could suddenly spread and they suddenly start to become more dominant. They grow their brains, they start language, and then we have computers and rovers on Mars. What would have happened if the asteroid wouldn't have hit? It's really very, very hard to know if an event is going to be bad or good in the long run. And that's why I'm so unsure about climate change and all these threats. I mean, are they going to make life in the long run worse, or maybe enable a whole new complexity of life which we can't even imagine now? Although I look at the world and think, okay, things could be a lot better and it's not heading in the right direction, that still this doesn't necessarily mean that it'll actually end up in such a bad state as I would predict.
It sounds like it could go either way, Linda.
Well, just a couple of weeks ago, Oxfam made this statement, which sort of picks up where he just left off. Quote, "This massive concentration of economic resources in the hands of fewer people presents a significant threat to inclusive political and economic systems. People are increasingly separated by economic and political power, inevitably heightening social tensions and increasing the risk of societal breakdown, close quote. That's what James Gladfelter feels, that we're on the precipice, and it could slide down into a form of self-destruction that could then reform itself back into another 20% driving 80% system, and that this keeps cycling over and over again. And I thought it would be interesting just for you to hear in the Coast audience who the top 20 of the 146 that can drive almost half of everything in that world network, and the 146 is at the top of the 750, which are driving 80%. So this is the top of the top, the creme de la creme. And at the very top is Barclays in Great Britain, followed by Capital Group companies in the U.S., FMR Corporation in the U.S., AXA in France, State Street Corporation in the U.S., J.P. Morgan Chase in the U.S., Legal and General in Great Britain, Vanguard Group, Inc. in the U.S., Merrill Lynch in the U.S., Wellington Management in the U.S., Deutsche Bank in Germany, Franklin Resources in the U.S., Credit Suisse in Switzerland, the State of France, Walton Enterprises in the U.S., Bank of New York Mellon Corporation in the U.S., Natixis in France, Goldman Sachs in the U.S., and T. Rowe Price in the U.S. And what most of you listening know is that at least two-thirds of that are purely in bank stocks, and the other companies that are on that 20 list are doing something interacting between lawyers and banks and stocks. So those are the top 20 of the 146 driving half of everything, all the money in the network that was studied by James Gladfelter.
And they're only going to get richer, Linda.
Well, we are on a planet where that was a question that was raised in President Obama's speech, State of the Union, last night, and follow-up. I read editorials today, is if the question, are the rich getting richer off of the expanding poor?
Maybe so. Maybe so. Linda, give us highlights of the website. People want to email you, track you down.
Earthfiles at earthfiles.com. Think of a reporter who files news about the earth. Earthfiles at earthfiles.com. And I have gained a great deal from people out there who have information sometimes from government and military, and you can communicate with me confidentially. And I think that out of this last story, what James Gladfelter was trying to point out is that if there are natural cycles, then we as humanity begin to understand that we become subject to cycles in a mathematical relationship, then we, in understanding it, we might be able to break those cycles and come up with a more equitable planet for ourselves, for nature, for the whole world.
And when we come back, it's called Conversations with Linda. Your call.